This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome to the Big Picture. Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour this week. Last week, we got into a subject of megatrends. We did a show about seven megatrends shaping our world coming up in the next decade. The retail ice age was the first one, and you can see that all around you as retailers are struggling to stay afloat. Second one, automation and the death of routine jobs, which has become an issue in the creation of jobs, even in the area of politics. Three, reverse migration and the Central Corridor. And we're talking about the Central Corridor of the United States as people move from various states depending on tax policies and other considerations of states, that people are going to where there are better tax policies, and that's where the jobs are going as well. Reshaping energy is number four, peak demand. What's energy going to look like over the next 10 years or so? Five, education, technology, and the age of guilds. Now, guilds are something you think go back to the Middle Ages, right? Well, you know, think again. Longevity and health, of course, that's an issue we discuss a lot on Lifetime Income on Mondays and Tuesdays here on the program. Orwell's World, referring to Big Brother being able to watch everything you do, think, say, or even intend to do, maybe. So this week, we're going to talk about the investment implications of all of these megatrends.
I want to start with the first one, which we called the retail ice age. And as we have talked on this subject and interviewed various experts, and you're probably seeing it, as you mentioned, John, you're seeing it in where you live. I see it here. They're closing down some of the big stores, Macy's, Nordstrom's, JCPenney's, Kmart, Sears. And if you take a look at what this means, what e-commerce or the internet has done to the retail space, 40% of the malls that are in existence today are going to disappear. And we're going to talk about what that's going to mean here in just a second for investing. And we've seen, especially coming in January and February, and again this week, there was a major announcement by Target. It did not meet its Christmas retail goals as it reported earnings. So you're seeing more and more of the big retailers, which used to be the anchor tenants in these big malls, they're closing stores. And the stores of the future are going to be much, much smaller. I want to talk about something as it applies to retailing. Retailing is not going to disappear. You know, there's something about still walking into a store, but the stores are going to look different. There are going to be fewer of them, and there are going to be fewer malls. But if you look at what's happened, and you can see this if you look at the bottom line in the profit margins of the major retailers, what e-commerce has done to retail profit margins. And I'm just looking at over the last 5 or 6 years, for example, Nordstrom's profit margins have fallen by 56%, Macy's by 36%, Kohl's by 60%, and JCPenney's by 98%. And when you get to Sears, they haven't made money since 2011. They've been losing money every single year. Now, all of this is good news for you and I as a consumer, because as a result of internet, what it has opened up is price transparency. So you can go on your smartphone, there's apps that are out there, and you can just type in an item that you're looking for, and all of a sudden, all these different places will show up on your phone or your laptop or tablet of where you can get a particular item, whether it's a TV set or some electronic device or whatever you're looking for at a cheaper price. And so for consumers, this has been a good thing to happen because we're able to buy things at a much cheaper price. I think I told the story last week where during Christmas, I went into Nordstrom's and I bought some shirts and ties for my sons. And one of my sons said, "Dad, I'm going to take it back." And I said, "I don't care." And he took it back, got a gift certificate, went on Nordstrom's online, and he got more than twice as much for the same amount of money. And so you're seeing this happen as retailers have to move in the digital space and e-commerce space if they're going to survive. And what the investment implications are for investing in the retail space, I don't care. Just pick up a Valueline or go to Yahoo Finance or something and just start looking at the financial data of these retailers over the last 5 or 6 years, and you're going to see a steady decline in profit margins. So what does that mean if you're a retailer? And this gets back to one of Warren Buffett's philosophies on a moat. And a moat is a protective barrier around a company or a business that protects it from its competitors. And one of the things that we've seen in retailing is you don't necessarily have to have high profit margins. For example, Warren Buffett has bought two companies in his own town, one called Nebraska Furniture Mart and another jewelry store called Borsham's. And these companies sell furniture and jewelry at some of the lowest prices that you can get anywhere in the United States. And so they're not making their money on their margins. They're making their money on inventory turnover. So the other way that retailers are going to have to learn to make money to stay profitable is, number one, they're going to have to get in the digital space. Number two, as their margins shrink, which they're still in the process of doing, meaning their profitability of maintaining that brick and mortar store is going to get harder and harder to maintain, what they're going to have to do is figure out a way on lower margins how to turn over their merchandise at a much faster rate. This is exactly what is done at Nebraska Furniture Mart and at Borsham's. Low margins, but faster turnover. And John, you see this in stores like Costco, which, they just missed their estimates, but they make the majority of their profits, believe it or not, on that annual membership fee that you pay to be a Costco shopper. In fact, they just raised it again, and that's to make up for what they're not making on margins, because Costco depends on two things. They have such low margins that they have to depend on those items of merchandise turning over rapidly. So if you have a small margin, but if you turn your inventory over more times a year, that's another way that you can stay profitable. But in the case of Costco, a lot of their profit margins come from that membership fee that you pay. So definitely the retail space is going to change in ways we've never seen before. The malls are going to look different. There are going to be fewer malls around. Like I said, 40% of your shopping malls are probably going to disappear. And the stores themselves are going to be much different. And there was a story this week that came out with Target. Target missed their fourth quarter goals. They are going to spend $2 billion to, number one, remodel their stores. Number two, drive down their prices. And the reason they're doing that is they're having to compete with the likes of Amazon and online retailers. And then the third thing that they're going to do is beef up their e-commerce space, meaning that they're going to put a lot of the stuff they carry in the stores, you're going to be able to get the same items in the stores online, probably for a cheaper price. So even giant retailers like Target are going to be revamping the way they do business. Smaller stores, larger online presence and e-commerce, and driving down the lower prices to compete with Amazon or the online retailers. So I think a lot of people, you like to go shopping. If you know that you can go to, let's say, a Target or any other store and get almost the same price that you could get it online, you're probably going to go to the local store, you'll get it there, and you can have it quicker. But even then, you take a look at companies like Amazon have gone to 7 days a week delivery. If I order a book, I can just as likely get it on Sunday. What they've done is almost like they've hired, like a paper route, they've hired local drivers in our neighborhood. So you can get like an Amazon route where you use your car, you go to a warehouse or stocking place, and you pick up orders that are delivered in your neighborhood. So just like we had paper routes, now you have Amazon routes. So all of this is changing the shape of retailing. And what you're going to have to look at with a lot of these retailers, if you're looking at a retailer, you better start looking at a 10-year track record of their financials and take a look at what has happened to their gross margins and profit margins, because they're shrinking. And if they're shrinking, you're going to have to ask yourself, how are they going to be able to maintain all these stores Or are they going to be doing as so many of these large chains are doing, is they're closing down? Last week, we went over a number of stores from Nordstrom's to Penny's to a lot of these stores are closing down and shrinking their brick and mortar space and beefing their e-commerce space. So in order to survive, these retailers are going to have to adapt to the digital age, or basically, as we talked about last week, they're going to go out of business. Another thing from an investment implication, we talked about this last week, you're really going to have to look at, if you were investing in a real estate investment trust, take a look at what that real estate investment trust is investing in. If they are investing in commercial real estate, like shopping malls, a lot of these REITs are just simply walking away from the properties and turning over the mortgage to the bank. As we talked about last week, there was a major mall in Pittsburgh. It used to be worth about $200 million. The real estate investment trust walked away from it, turned it over to the bank, Wells Fargo, who ended up selling it for like half the price at $100 million. So this is going to impact the holdings of retailers, and especially if you're a mortgage REIT or if you are a commercial REIT. So investing in this space, you know, what the internet has done is created price discovery, and it is commoditized the retail space. It's good news for consumers, not necessarily good news for retailers. So the retail space, I hate to say it, for retailers is going to get even more competitive.
This next one's a sort of a hotspot for politics because of obviously President Trump's promising to bring back more jobs into manufacturing areas. However, we're discovering that more and more manufacturing is becoming automated. Robots are doing the job, and then the people who operate and maintain the robots need to have higher specialization. So item number two is automation and the death of routine jobs.
Yeah, some of the investment implications, you're really going to look at companies and industries that are able to automate. And then also taking a look at companies that make the automation equipment, because that's what people are doing. And I was reading on some of the major auto manufacturers where, let's say in Mexico, you can make an automobile for $25,000 per worker, and the equivalent in the U.S. is $120,000. Now, if you invest in a robot, it's, let's say, $50,000. It takes you a little over 2 years to make your money back by investing in that robot. And so this is something that you are going to see more and more in the manufacturing space, in the service sector space. Automation is hitting a wide swath of jobs and occupations. There was a major study done in 2013 that looked at 700 occupations. 47% of those jobs are at risk of potential automation. Everything from delivery people to receptionists to cashiers to counter and retail clerks to telemarketers and accountants. And, you know, if you take a look at this, you wouldn't think it. But the jobs that are subject to automation, here's one: health technologist will be replaced in many ways through automation and computers. Economist, commercial pilots. You know, John, you're a pilot. I mean, I know we're seeing it in warfare. We're seeing some guy in Iowa with a joystick and he's flying a drone over in Afghanistan. But I don't know, would you feel comfortable getting on a 737 knowing that, you know, some guy in a joystick is flying that plane?
Yeah, I wonder why he doesn't want to commit himself. Yeah, you've got a number of issues there. It's one thing because all the planes today are computerized. You know, if you look at, they're literally fly-by-wire type of airplanes, but they have real humans sitting there monitoring it who have a stake in this game. What happens when somebody hacks the computer system of an airliner and crashes it as an act of terrorism?
Well, I mean, even take a look at during the Christmas holidays, I watched the movie Scully. I mean, think of the fast reaction that pilot, even though the simulation and everything told him that, hey, he should head for an airport, his own judgment of 40 years of flying said, I'm not going to make it to that airport, which later came out in the investigation of the crash. So you think about it, folks, that may sound unrealistic, but think of all the drones that are out there today that are used in the military sphere. How much longer will it make its way into the commercial sphere? I just don't know about you, John. I don't know. When I get on a plane and fly someplace, I want to know that there's a couple pilots in the cockpit. Don't you?
Yeah, you want somebody with skin in the game, so to speak. In other words, that there's somebody on board that you can override whatever is happening when you see something else. And by the way, on that whole bit, remember on the simulator for Sully's thing, when they finally get down to the hearing, he says, well, now that you've had your fun, you know, well, what do you mean? This is a serious inquiry. He says, yeah, but how many times did it take you in the simulator to get it right to return to LaGuardia Airport? And they said 21. He said, we had one. We had one chance.
You know? Yeah, we had one chance. You know, so they're talking about the automation of commercial pilots, but, you know, maybe that's for making deliveries. So maybe FedEx uses a drone flying jet to make a delivery, but I don't know. I think passengers, you're going to have to do a lot of talking to get people on a plane knowing that there's no human on board if something goes wrong. Other jobs that are going to be automated, continuing with the list, machinist, word processor, typist, and here's one that's going to be a big one for opening up to bringing down cost. Real estate agents, right now, real estate commissions are about 5 or 6%. Those are going to be coming down dramatically. Look for online realtors that are going to bring down the cost of selling a home. Technical writers, retail salespeople. I mean, if you shrink the size of the store and you go online and you buy something, just think of the number of retail clerks that are going to disappear in some of these stores, accountants, auditors, and telemarketers. And so a lot of this is going to be automated, and the place where we're seeing higher pay, greater security, and greater demand is really in non-routine cognitive jobs are soaring compared to, let's say, non-routine manual or routine manual or routine cognitive type jobs. So the whole industry and the way the economy works is changing dramatically. And I just don't think a lot of the politicians have really kept up with this. And really what you want to look at, if you're looking as a result of automation, you want to look at companies that are disruptors of an industry. Think of what Facebook and Google did to the advertising industry. Think of what Netflix and Amazon is doing to network television. Or think of what LinkedIn did to the recruiting industry. So what you're really looking for is the future disruptors, because with automation, AI, and technology, there's going to be further disruption of long-established monopolies that the monopolistic walls are being knocked down with technology.
Yeah, one of the lights on this thing, though, you know, is, okay, some jobs are going to go away, but other jobs are coming into existence. It's just a matter of being trained for them.
Well, let me give you an example. I mean, with banking, we have ATMs. So you can walk up to an ATM and get cash. You don't have to walk into a bank. And as a result of these ATMs, banks were able to bring down their branch employment from 20 employees down to 13. However, what happened as the cost of opening up a branch came down because there were fewer employees, banks opened up more branches. So suburban bank branches rose by 43%. So even though there were fewer employees per branch, there are now 43% more branches. Same thing is happening in the legal field, where you have, for example, there's software that's capable of analyzing large volumes of legal documents that have to be looked at by legal clerks and paralegals in terms of the discovery phase of a case. But here's the thing that happened. As a result of automation reducing the cost of discovery, it increased the demand for it. So judges are more willing to allow discovery now because it's cheaper and easier. So the number of legal clerks in America has actually gone up by 1%. So, John, it's not all bad news. Automation refines jobs rather than destroys them. And one of the things that they found in some of these studies done on automation is that employment grew significantly faster in occupations that made more use of computers. What happened as a result is automation sped up one aspect of the job, enabling workers to do other parts better. So the net effect was that more computer-intensive jobs within an industry displaced less computer-intensive ones, computers, thus reallocate rather than displace jobs, requiring workers, and here's the key, to learn new skill sets. So this thing about automation, there's a couple of key things you can walk away with. One, look for the technology disruptors. As I mentioned, Facebook in advertising, Netflix, LinkedIn. These are the companies that are disrupting a new industry or assaulting an apparent monopoly. I mean, think of what happened when you think back of it at one time. And these were Buffett-type companies in the 70s when you had three networks that controlled all advertising and anything you watched on television. You had a choice of three networks. Then we got cable TV. Then we got satellite TV. And then we got Netflix. Think of what happened when the internet opened up, what it did to the monopoly of the local newspaper. I remember I used to do seminars in the 80s and 90s, and I only had one choice in this town. If I wanted to advertise for a seminar, I had to pick the Sunday edition of the local newspaper, and I had to pay whatever the advertising rates were. Well, look what we're doing with a podcast and the internet. So look for technology disruptors.
This one is interesting. This next one, reverse migration. And we're talking about the central corridor of the United States being driven by a number of factors, but there it is.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at where is it most expensive to live, you'll probably find it on the West Coast and on the East Coast. And since World War II, it was kind of like, go West, young man. The population centers moved and migrated to the Pacific or the Pacific Southwest. And, you know, you had towns and states garner population. I mean, California has, what, 11-12% of the country's population. You had states like Washington, Oregon, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, Texas, and a lot of these states, even New Mexico, that boomed with new population. However, if you take a look at now where the cost and where the taxes and where the regulations are the highest are on the West Coast and the East Coast. And if you look at where companies are building factories, you know, Apple's not building a factory in California, nor is Intel. Intel and Apple are building factories in Phoenix, Arizona, or they're building factories in Austin, Texas. So if you look at this trend, when companies move to an area where they can build a factory with less regulations, less taxation, in fact, favorable tax benefits, it creates jobs. When it creates jobs, that creates tax revenues. And that's the key thing that you're going to want to look at. There are a number of companies that are actually bringing factories back to the U.S. This will probably accelerate under the Trump administration. Companies from Apple to Bayer to Amazon to Ford to IBM to Walmart, Sprint, Lockheed Martin, Hyundai Motors. All of these companies are coming back here because, you know, one of the things when you start looking at labor and especially with automation, the real key is a robot. A robot, once you make the initial investment in a robot, that's it. That robot you can have for 10, 15, 20 years making and programming and doing things versus a worker. And so labor becomes less of a factor in the decision, and the decisions become, where do I locate a factory? What are the more favorable tax benefits? If you look at some of the companies, Chinese companies, Korean companies moving to the U.S. because of tax factors, and that could accelerate if Trump gets his tax bill through where he lowers corporate tax rates here in the U.S. from their 35% rate down to 20 or 15%. So if you want to look at this kind of mega trend where you have the West Coast and the East Coast moving more towards the center, where the jobs are being created, where the cost of living is cheaper, where the taxes are lower, where the environment, regulatory environment is more favorable. And so the investment implications here, and especially if you're investing in real estate, where are going to be the hottest areas for real estate investment in the next 10 years? It's going to be where companies are moving and building factories because you move and build a factory in a state, what does that do? It attracts more workers and creates more jobs. Those jobs create ancillary type jobs that evolve around that particular industry. So look for real estate to be more opportune in those areas, and also look for real estate investment trusts who will be investing in this area, because people go where the jobs are created. And when you look at the cost of real estate on the West Coast, which is 2.5 times the rest of the country, or look to expensive places like New Jersey, New York, how expensive they've become. Well, guess what? People are going to move, and companies are going to move where they can build a factory and operate it much cheaper, as well as workers get a lot more take home. You take an executive. If you were an executive, where would you want to work? California, where the top income tax rate is 13.3. We have the highest sales taxes, some of the highest property taxes. Or would you rather go to, let's say, Arizona, where the income tax is 2.5%, the cost of living is cheaper, property taxes are cheaper, or go to Texas where they don't even have income taxes. So all of this is creating this trend that we're going to see in the next 10 years. This gets back to Meredith Whitney, the credit analyst, her theory in her book about the Central Corridor as being the next emerging market for the United States.
Energy is something we discuss very frequently here on the program, and one of the mega trends is reshaping what the nature of energy is. And peak demand, as civilizations go up, they demand more energy, and the question is always where that's going to come from.
Well, when it comes to the investment implications of energy, I mean, we're seeing more clean energy. You're seeing more hybrids. Electric cars are going to start to dominate the percentage of cars that are owned. You're seeing that percentage increase. I got my first electric hybrid. I charge it at night, and my house is powered by solar energy. So, you know, the sun is powering my car. When I used to buy, you know, a tank or a tank and a half of gas a week, now I can go 2 months without even getting a tank of gas. But what does this mean for investing in energy? Well, if you take a look at the last decade, when oil prices got down to $10 a barrel in 1998, they got all the way up to $150 a barrel in the summer of 2008. Oil companies made fortunes as the price of oil rose. However, what we saw happen beginning in 2014, the price of oil went from $114 a barrel all the way down to $26 a barrel. Now, it's twice that now, but the smaller leveraged companies went under. The more efficient companies survived. So if you take a look at how energy companies make money in the future, if you're an oil company, there's only two ways you're going to make money and grow. Number one, if oil companies are all selling their oil at the same price, the price of oil is quoted, whether it's WTI or it's Brent, okay, you're selling your oil for the same price the other guy's selling. In general, there's only two other ways that you're going to increase your profits and get rewarded by the marketplace. One is you increase your top line in unit production, meaning that just like you increase sales each year, you increase sales by producing more barrels of oil. So that's how you grow your top line. The second way that you increase your profits is by lowering the cost of production. Even the bigger oil companies are jettisoning some of their least productive oil fields that are more expensive to operate, especially in a price where you're looking at a trading range, a narrow trading range for oil. Well, if you have a very expensive field, you're getting rid of it, trying to sell it to somebody that might be able to get better productive use out of it, or at least automate it. But basically, you want to lower your cost of production. And what we're seeing right now, even some of the most bullish people I know on oil see oil maybe. Kurt Wolf, as he talked about, his price for oil in the next couple of years is $70 a barrel. So you could see oil trade in a narrow range between $50 and $70 a barrel, very much like we saw for almost three decades. We saw the price of oil trade between $10 and $20 a barrel. So you can look at OPEC as being the floor underneath the price of oil, and U.S. shale as being the cap. So it's more important when you're looking at the future, investing in the area, to look at companies that have the ability to increase their production, number one. Number two, they can lower their costs by either the oil fields that they invest their money in or the role that technology plays. I mentioned last week, Exxon is using supercomputers on mapping reservoirs on land in the deep ocean. Their latest project, they used over 22,000 6,000 computers. So the market, if you take a look at price multiples in the industry, how do you stand out and distinguish yourself from everybody else? The market rewards companies that are growing their production and lowering their cost. They're awarded higher PE multiples. So that's going to be one of the keys if you want to invest in energy companies going forward.
Next topic is one that's always been dear to my heart. We have an educational system in the country that needs to be fixed. Also, college is becoming very, 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 very expensive. Having put three kids through, I know what that can be all about. And technology is changing the way people learn and where they learned. It was always amazing to me, Jim, when my son was running a lot of his programs, there's a supercomputer at the college where he was at. He was running a lot of chemical plots for his PhD work, but he could work on that while he was here at home just by having a laptop accessing a supercomputer, you know, 1500 miles away. And so the whole nature of what we can do nowadays is really impressive, and it's changing the shape of education and how people will learn in the future.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I mentioned last week in the class of 2015, only 15% of the graduates had meaningful jobs. And despite that, John, we're graduating more people than ever from college, and yet a lot of them go without a job. And there's a growing demand in the service and manufacturing field for highly skilled jobs. And I think what you're going to see, as we talked about automation, whether it's in the banking field, whether it's in manufacturing, whether it's in restaurants, whether it's in retailing, I think you're going to see the rise of what we call trade schools, and you're seeing it take place at the junior college level, where companies are teaming up with junior colleges and saying, you know, we need to come up with a special program that has these kind of elements of skill sets built into them, because this is what we need on our factory floor. So you're also seeing with the internet the rise of online education. I have a client, and we've talked about this on Lifetime Income, and we'll do another series on this when it comes to May, when it comes to graduation time. But one of my clients took our advice as a result of a financial plan that we did for this couple. They had three kids. They simply couldn't afford to send all three kids to even a state school, which could run, you know, 70 to 80,000 per kid. You multiply that times three, you're talking about almost $250,000. And so what has happened is one of her sons graduated from high school. Instead of going the normal paradigm, which is junior goes away to, let's say, a state school, you have room and board and tuition, which can run up to 20 grand a year. Instead, a junior got a job. And what he's doing is he's going to an online college at night. So he works during the day. He lives at home. So what are parents not incurring? They're not having to pay for room and board. His job that he earns a living from or gets paid for is enough to pay the tuition fees for his online education, which is much cheaper than going to a state school. So this is a whole paradigm in these companies, and he's going to a company that is a for-profit institution, and you're going to see these online profit institutions start to compete with the brick and mortar school systems, and especially for these cognitive type of jobs that there's such great demand for. So look for the technology disruptors in the field of education that are going to disrupt education in the same way the internet disrupted online retailing. And so, you know, the next sector and monopoly to get broken down by technology will be the public education system. And so, number one, the cost of the education has gotten too high for college. It's rising at 4 to 6% a year. For the last couple decades, it's gone up at 7 to 8% per year. So you're going to see the emergence of online trade schools. They're cheaper. They can accelerate learning. In this particular couple, their son, instead of taking courses per semester, is taking the equivalent of a semester course every 5 weeks. And so he's going through his education. He can get it done in a faster amount of time and for less money. So here's an individual that is living at home, and when he gets his college degree, will leave college without an ounce or a dollar of debt.
So, and this is going to be an interesting trend because it's happening in public education too. You know, the big debate coming here is going to be whether or not we have choice, whether parents will be allowed to send their kids where they want to so that schools can compete. And we're already discovering that various charter schools, homeschools, and private schools are doing much of their education online. And you can see this graduating very quickly to e-schools that are really disruptors, I guess you'd call them, of the current system. Instead of trotting off to college, and mom and dad going into mountains of debt to get you through the college, and then you have to come out and deal with this when you assume your job, this will all change. They'll be operating out of home, maybe have a job, maybe have to go to certain meetings several times a year, all sorts of different things. But this is a radical change from the we go to live on campus or we have an apartment near the campus and have to go somewhere.
Yeah, and the other thing too, it's not just that it's going to change the whole education paradigm, but what's going to be very important for students to know in advance is where are the jobs? What fields are these jobs taking place, or where are the job openings? Just as I mentioned, all those jobs are going to get automated. You better make sure, and especially if you're going to pay for it yourself and go to an online education, you're more likely to get a degree or some kind of education background that will train you technology-wise or technically for a job in these fields that we're talking about that require cognitive skills. So, for example, if you're going to work a factory robot, you might get involved in some kind of program where you're going to have to learn engineering, computer science, mathematics, and also you better do the research in terms of what those fields are and where those companies are located, because this fits in, John. Not only does education tie into this migration, but they're all interlinked. The idea about automation, the idea about the change in education, and the idea about the change of migration, all three of these are interconnected. And it reinforces this reverse migration trend, because where these companies are opening up factories, whether it's Apple, Intel, eBay, it's not in California. It's not in New York. It's more likely Arizona, Texas, or someplace in the South. So from an investment point of view, take a look at these education disruptors.
Okay, now the next one here is that we're all living to be 150 years old, you know. And after I retire, somebody's got to feed me. The next topic is longevity and health, which it sounds like a good thing until you realize it has consequences.
Well, I mean, there's a number of things from retirement to investing. We talk a lot about this on our Lifetime Income show. But one trend, it's a demographic trend that is accelerating, is the world's population is aging. In the United States and Europe, China, Japan, and that's the population is aging globally. So what does that mean? We're living longer. And there's going to be greater demand for medical services, which will include everything from doctors, hospitals, nurses, to technicians. And the implications for that, if you want to look at a growth industry that has demographics working for it, it is in the health field. You know, as we age, we use more drugs. So the pharmaceutical industry, as we age, we use more medical devices, whether it's hip replacement, knee replacement. As we age and get older, it's also going to change housing. So we're seeing senior housing communities where you move in. And especially we see a lot of this happen when people get into their late 70s and 80s. They move into a retirement living facility. We're seeing them pop up all over. And in fact, right down from our office, they just built another one. So from a real estate, senior living, and also we're seeing technology. And I talked about this, you know, if you have an Apple Watch or maybe you have a Fitbit, we have all these devices that we can use now to monitor heartbeat, to blood pressure, to calories, to the number of steps you take. Well, coming soon in the next 5 to 10 years, I have a good friend who's a cardiologist, and he keeps saying, you know what? Stay in shape for the next 7 years. The advancements that are coming to heart disease are just going to astound you. And so we're going to have devices, he was telling me about, that they'll have that can monitor your body vitals. It'll be just as ubiquitous as, let's say, health watches are today. So the other thing you're seeing pop up all over, as people live longer, they stay healthier, you're seeing the diet change, and this is going to have implications for junk food companies or soft drink companies. You're seeing health services from fitness clubs to yoga to Pilates studios. You're seeing advances in exercise equipment. When I moved here to California, I bought my first gym in 1983. I met two guys. They were kind of surfer guys that working out of a warehouse on the beach near Del Mar. And with their technology, both of them were engineers. They loved to surf, but they were into body fitness. And they built a health company that builds gym machines that have now displaced the company that once had a monopoly on the business, Nautilus. And so you're seeing advances in exercise equipment. And so the other implication for aging population is as we live longer, we need to be dependent on our investments and our portfolios for income. So investments that produce income or an increasing stream of income are going to be ever more important for investment portfolios. So there's all kinds of things. If there's one industry that has the demographics and everything going for it, it is the healthcare industry. And you can see this reflected in a lot of the healthcare stocks.
Next one is one that really concerns me, and that's Orwell's world, referring to George Orwell. We are coming more into an age when governments are enforcing politically correct thought and speech. And with the technology today, they can know everything that you see, hear, say, do, or want to invest in, etc., and try to control that. So that's of concern.
That is, and we're seeing that as government tracks and monitors more of its citizens. We're also seeing some of the problems that many companies, from all the way to the U.S. government itself, to even large companies like Target, where hackers get into their database. So you're going to take a look at, here's an area where you have programs that create privacy. I mean, this week, Snapchat went public, and one of the ideas about Snapchat, as I understand it, is whatever you text or you put on in terms of a picture or video, it disappears. And once it disappears, it's gone. So there's going to be programs that, you know, just like the criminals are always looking for advances, you're also going to be doing the same thing, looking for companies, the software companies, in terms of cybersecurity is going to become ever more important, and companies that create programs that keep your privacy. So this is going to be more important. So, you know, these are just seven trends, John. There's a couple more trends we'll probably cover, but we'll make them as unique shows in themselves. And one of them is going to be a major paradigm shift for investment markets. We'll talk about that in a separate program.
And one way or another, those megatrends are headed our way. And the other thing we know about megatrends is they tend to morph and change as we go, which means you have to be watching them as they come and go and as you participate and invest in them. We'll be back with the second part of the Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Pavlova or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The intermediate-term proprietary model and the short-term proprietary model flipped positive the week before the presidential election, suggesting there was going to be a rally no matter who was elected. Obviously, the Trump win put further legs on this thing. The model suggested the markets were going to continue to go up and that the first window of downside opportunity would arrive in late January or early February. So I'm a little cautious right here, but I have never varied. Our long-term proprietary model flipped positive in October of 08, which is when most stocks bottomed, not in March of 09. The indexes kept going down because the financials kept going down. But the most of the market's components bottomed in October of 08. Our model turned positive, and the long-term model has never flipped negative since then. So I continue to think we remain in a secular bull market. They usually last 14, 15, 16 years. So we ought to have another 6, 7, 8 years left in this thing.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Big Picture here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. Well, we began this year. Well, we actually scunched it back into December of last year. The Fed raised interest rates for the second time, and then they changed their forecast to 2017 to 3 rate hikes. Until recently, people were only thinking that the Fed was going to go twice, give us 2 bumps this year. But now it looks like 3 rate hikes are a possibility. And people thought they would wait until June, but we do have an FOMC meeting coming up. And it looks now they could actually raise rates again this month. So this is a change. What do you think is occasioning the change, Jim?
Well, a number of things. And we just take a look at the major stock market indexes on election eve and where they are today. The Dow has gone from 17,888 all the way to 21,016. That's an increase of 17.5%. And then you also have the S&P, which is slightly under 2,100 today. It's almost at 2,400. It's up 14%. The NASDAQ has gone from 5,000 to almost 5,900. It's up 16%. So one of the things that I think has allowed the Fed to even consider raising rates, and I would say, John, this is probably the biggest reason of all, is the stock market. Because if you look at economic growth, it hasn't been there. And in fact, the fourth quarter was revised to only 1.9%, which was lower than economic growth in the third quarter. So it certainly wasn't on economic trends. Although, if you take a look at recently, inflation trends have been picking up. So there's another reason. That's reason number two. And number three, the LEIs have been heating up. ISM manufacturing, it was 51.7 in September of last year. It just hit 57.7 in February. New orders are accelerating. ISM service has gone from 54.9 in September. Its recent reading was 57.6. So you have three things that are moving all at the same time, which is allowing the Fed to go early. One, the market rally, the double-digit rally that we've seen across all the markets. Two, economic growth is picking up. And number three, inflation is starting to heat up. So I think this is one of the reasons that I think the markets in the Fed feels a little bit more comfortable in raising rates, because I guarantee you, if the stock market was down like it was last year, remember last year at this very same time in the month of March, the Fed had already flip-flopped from raising rates 4 times to Janet Yellen going up on Capitol Hill, backpedaling, and then, of course, their March FOMC meeting where they said, well, maybe we're going to kind of hold off for a while. You contrast that to a year later with a roaring stock market, and now they're saying you've had a number of Fed governors come out this week, all supporting the idea that it looks like they're going to raise rates 2 weeks from now.
You know, I know that you've discovered in times past that when you track the futures market, it's actually been more predictive of what the Fed will actually do rather than what the Fed says. So what is the futures market saying right now?
Well, it's basically saying the same thing. I mean, if you look at the futures market, we've gone from a probability of only a 40% chance in March, and this was about a month ago. If you take a look at the latest reading at the CME, it has an 80% probability that they go in March, which is rather interesting. So we've almost doubled that probability. So given Yellen's speech this Friday, the futures market is corroborating the idea that the Fed goes as soon as this month, which is a sharp contrast of where we were at the beginning of the year, given the fact that the Fed has always been aggressive in terms of how many rate hikes it's going to begin the year with. 2015 was a good example. They only raised rates once. 2016 was another example. Instead of 4 times, they went once. And so when the Fed said in December, hey, we're going to go from 2 to 3, people were saying, I'm not sure. And the consensus was they would wait to June before we see the first rate hike. And I think the difference has been this roaring stock market. So the futures market is basically saying they go in March. Now, the next meeting the Fed has is in May. The probability that they go beyond let's say a Fed funds rate of 1 is only 8.5% right now for the month of May. So the likelihood that they go at their next meeting, in other words, two back-to-back months where they would raise interest rates, I just don't think they could be confident enough. You would have to go to June, where the probability they go to, let's say, a Fed funds rate, raise it another quarter point, the probability right now is close to 40%. So they could go in June. My bet, based on what we're seeing right now, based on economic trends, inflationary trends, and also what we're seeing going on in the market, they raise rates in March, which is 2 weeks from now. And then what they do is just kind of sit back, see how the market handles the quarter point rate hike. I mean, we'll get into this in just a second. I mean, Yellen gave a speech this Friday, basically said, hey, we're probably going to end up raising rates this month. And so far, that has had very little effect on the market. We'll talk about its implications. So what I suspect they're going to do is raise in March, watch economic trends to see if it slows down, watch the inflationary trends, and then also watch what's happening in the economy. And then the next likelihood is they go probably in June. And if you go to the July meeting, there's only an 8% probability they would raise beyond a quarter of a point in June. If you go to September, the probability of raising is even less. It's probably, well, rises a little bit, goes up to 21%. Then you go to November. At that point, the probability of going to a quarter basis point, let's say taking the Fed funds rate to 1.5, is 24%. And then you go to December, and that is roughly about 33%. So if you look at the probabilities in terms of the futures market is basically saying they go in March, they go in June, and then they go in December. And so it's a big, big if after they do this. I think they're going to be very cautious, but I think they will go early. And I think we'll see that in March. So if you take a look at what is going in favor of a rate hike right now, the stock market is the number one reason. Economic growth is picking up and the inflation targets are heading higher.
Our individual projections for the appropriate path for the federal funds rate reflect economic forecasts that generally envision that economic activity will expand at a moderate pace in coming years, labor market conditions will strengthen somewhat further, and inflation will be at or near 2% over the medium term. In short, we currently judge that it will be appropriate to gradually increase the federal funds rate if the economic data continue to come in about as we expect. Indeed, at our meeting later this month, the committee will evaluate whether employment and inflation are continuing to evolve in line with our expectations, in which case, a further adjustment of the federal funds rate would likely be appropriate.
That was Janet Yellen speaking on Friday this week. And based on what she's saying, it looks like it's a go for March for a rate hike.
Yeah, and we're also seeing not just confirmation in the futures market, as I mentioned, with probabilities, 80% probability for a rate hike this month, and also a 40% probability for June, which everybody was expecting at the beginning of the year. But you're also seeing it confirmed in the bond market. If you take a look at two-year Treasury yields, they've popped up to a little over 1.3%. That's the first time, John, we've seen two-year Treasury notes at this level in 7 years. If you also look at three-month Treasury bills, they're almost at 0.75%. So we're looking at the T-bill and the Treasury note market are confirming this same trend along with the futures market. You know, the amazing thing about this, it's hard to believe that last summer, three-month T-bills were at a negative interest rate, meaning you would pay the government to invest in three-month T-bills. And here we are on this Friday with Treasury bills at almost a little over 0.7%. So there's a lot of implications here. If the Fed goes in 2 weeks and they raise the Fed funds rate to 1%, folks, we're still at a very low interest rate. It's hard to believe that when Greenspan began the Fed rate raising cycle that led to the Great Recession, they began raising interest rates in 2004, but the Fed funds rate was at 1%. this rate raising cycle, they began with the Fed funds rate from a 0 to 0.25%. So we're basically, after this next rate raising, let's say that comes this month, we're back to where we were in 2004. Now, here's the interesting thing that's going to come in afterwards, because Fed governors have come out and said, in addition to raising rates, we're also looking at another measure to do tightening, and we're talking about shrinking the Fed's balance sheet of $4.5 trillion. And the way they could do that is, as these bonds come due, they simply would not invest the proceeds. So this year, you've got about $200 billion of bonds coming due in 2017. 2018 is a big year, $450 billion. So the Fed technically could reduce its balance sheet by close to $500 billion in the next year. So the question is, what happens afterwards if they keep raising?
But we come back here to the issue of whether or not the Fed gets overconfident, which they seem to have done in times past. And they say, we're going to go. But what happens is they suddenly get there, they discover the economy's creaking along, and then they decide not to do it. Maybe that lesson hasn't been learned here, or what they're trying to do is ride the wave of market optimism up that's the result of Donald Trump and make the rate hike sort of camouflaged underneath that so they can ride that wave up.
Yeah, I think there's two things that are giving them the confidence to do that right now. One is the stock market itself. But I don't think they could be that confident that they could raise rates in March and then go as soon as May. So I just don't see that happen. Now, a lot of this is based on, and the questions the market has, is can the Trump administration with stimulus bring that stimulus online, which is one of the rallying factors of why we're seeing stock markets at these record levels, because Trump is saying, number one, he's going to peel Obamacare along with its Obamacare taxes. He's going to cut corporate and individual tax rates. He's going to increase infrastructure, and he's going to decrease regulation. The problem is, John, as we're seeing already, the Democrats are opposed to the president's programs, and even some members of his own party aren't on board. About the only agreement between Republicans and Democrats now in terms of the president's agenda is on infrastructure spending. The Democrats are not on board on deregulation. They're not on board with tax cuts, and they certainly aren't on board with Obamacare repeal. So, and even in the president's own party, we're having disagreements in terms of, you know, the concept is repeal and replace. And John, we haven't seen a replacement yet. So the question is, can this stimulus get enacted in time to offset rate hikes coming from the Fed in March and June? And about the only thing the president can do that would be effective in terms of stimulus in the short term would be tax cuts, because we know infrastructure spending could be 2 to 3 years before, even if it's passed this year, it could be 2 to 3 years before it comes online. It's one of the reasons why we have mentioned that the market has probably gotten ahead of itself. So everybody's watching what's going to happen, and I'm sure the Fed will. This market rally, will it continue, or will something happen in the meantime?
Yeah, we're seeing this agreement going on there because the futures market seems to be there. In the bond market, interest rates are starting to rise. What else?
Well, I mean, we're seeing rising interest rates in the bond market, especially on the short end. This is also impacting the dollar. The dollar is getting stronger, which is bad news for gold. So you've seen gold weaken. Gold is down to 1235. It was almost close to 1260. And it's also slowing down the stock market rally. I mean, we had a rip-roaring rally this week with the Dow up 300 points in a single day. So it's going to be amazing to watch this go forward now that the Feds, this is the last time you're going to see any Fed governors talking about what they're going to do. They sort of go into this blackout period a couple of weeks before a Fed meeting. But it looks like it's a go for a March rate hike. The question is, what will the market start to build in as we head closer to May and June? And what will this do to the dollar, which also hurts export earnings for companies, especially multinational companies in the S&P 500 and the Dow itself? But right now, looks like rate hikes are set to accelerate.
So I guess we're going to do what we've been doing for the last 24 months, Jim. We're going to wait and see, right, when it comes to Fed rate hikes. 2 years there, we were going through the, they're going to do it, they're going to do it. Oh, they didn't do it. They're going to do it. Oh, they didn't do it. But now this may be changing. And of course, we have an FOMC thing coming up on the 15th of this month. And that's when we'll be able to determine what it is they're going to do. Anything else on the horizon?
Now, I would say the main thing that's given the Fed confidence right now is what they've seen happen in the stock market. They've been talking about raising rates since the beginning of the year with this rally that began the day after the election, the Trump rally. And so that has probably given them more confidence than anything else, John, because it certainly hasn't been the recent economic numbers. And you certainly can't say, even though inflation is picking up, inflation is roaring. So I think the market is the key to all of this. So that's something we're going to have to keep our eyes on. How does the market react going forward? And after they raise rates one time, I think it's going to be important to say what they say in their minutes. In other words, do they hit that? Yep, looks like we're going to go in May and June. So outside FOMC meeting, what we're also going to be looking out for, we're watching the LEI numbers, the ISM manufacturing and service numbers ticking up, new orders ticking up. So that's looking good for economic growth. The other thing coming up here in the next couple of weeks, we're going to get into Q1 earnings season. So if you're a company and you're going to miss your estimates, you're probably going to want to get that out of the way. And so we're going to watch first quarter earnings. We'll be into Q1 earnings season next month. So FOMC meeting, economic numbers, and Q1 earnings, all that coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.